Hello and welcome into episode 4 of You Seem Interesting. I'm your host, Danny Ruye. If you're listening to this show on Patreon, thank you very much. That means you are one of our subscribers. That is the lifeblood of the show. So thank you guys so much for already supporting. If you're checking me out on a different platform, you're more than welcome to do that. Spread the word, rate, review, subscribe, all of those wonderful things. Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all of that good stuff. And please, please, please check us out on Twitter as well. At interest_pod. Suggestions are always welcome there for people that you want to hear on the show, some different ideas and things. Love to have interactions there on that medium. But once again, thank you to all my subscribers. And the back catalog's available there for you as well. Episodes 1, 2, and 3. Last week, we talked to Mary Bruce of ABC News. She covers Capitol Hill and Congress for ABC News nationally. She was terrific. This week, we're talking beer. That's right. My guest will be Ben Evans. He is the head brewer at a local brewery here in Washington, D.C., where I live, called Hellbender. But he could be any thousands of guys and gals across the country that are doing this, that are in this world that didn't exist, you know, a few decades ago. The microbrewery, the rise of the local brewery, that is something that is pretty unique here that's taken place over the last, you know, 15, 20 years. There's been a renaissance, and we'll get into some numbers pretty soon here that sort of support that. And you know the feeling, right? You're in the grocery store in the beer aisle, and you know it's going to be Budweiser, it's going to be Coors, it's going to be Miller in some capacity. Well, now you're stock full of more options than you have ever had, and a lot of them are from your local brew chains. And there are some challenges therein, and there are some hurdles, and there's some rewards, and a whole bunch of other fun things. And we'll cover that with Ben here in a moment. So I'm excited to jump in to some of those details here. But as we usually do around this time, this is the awkward part. That's where I ask you for money. In order to take the awkwardness out of that, I have committed to impersonating a celebrity each of the first 3 weeks, and I will do that here in week number 4. This week, former pro wrestler Stone Cold Steve Austin begs you to subscribe to the show.
Well, I don't give a damn what you think your situation is. You go to patreon.com/funnydanny and put some dang money down. Put your money where your mouth is. Get yourself a membership tier. There's 4 different ones right there. You go ahead and get down to $5, $10, $20, $30. You got different benefits. I'll tell you what tier I would choose. It's tier 316. We go up to your room. I'd put a stunner on your ass and force you to commit. And that's the bottom line.
Sorry for shouting that. That's Stone Cold Steve Austin. I can't do that one quietly, by the way. That's a really hard one to do in a whisper voice. I couldn't do Stone Cold Steve Austin in a library only shouting at you about joining patreon.com/funnydanny. So again, thank you very much, guys, for checking out the show. So let's jump into it here. Beer. You love it. You're here. You're listening to this episode. Maybe you found us in a certain way because you like beer. You know that you want more choices than ever. You know what the standard bearers offer. There's nothing wrong, by the way, with cracking a Miller Lite on a nice summer evening. There's nothing wrong with going butt heavy at a bar. It's dependable. It's faithful. It has been there and will continue to be. There's something said, there's something admirable about the big guys, right? They have a formula. A Budweiser tastes the same in Rhode Island as it does in Colorado or in North Dakota or in Florida. That's a testament. That's really, really neat, right? You think about the way sodas are bottled, way different drinks, you know, with the shipping of ingredients and different things, the regional breweries that ship those national beers, and it should taste the same no matter where you are. That's neat. That's not something that this new microbrew movement has really diminished. I think that's something that shouldn't be ignored here when we have this conversation. But you know there's now more choice than ever. There's now such a highly and hyper-competitive market when it comes to microbrews. The victories for these breweries sometimes are small. They sort of offer this in-stadium kind of thing, right? We're thinking about watching a sport on television. Teams are happy that you're doing that, but they really, really want you to buy a ticket. They really want you to come spend money at the brewery or at the stadium. In this case, the brewer is the same deal, right? You offer some really neat perks. You get people in the door. You can sell food. You can have them experience some things, get some behind the scenes, and you tend to become a fan of that beer. Hellbender here in D.C. is no different. There are thousands of these examples across the country, and we'll get into some of the specific numbers here in a second. But think about how crowded the beer market is at this stage, right? It's so competitive, and you're not going to know unless you give one a try. So what goes into you deciding to give one a try? The can, the bottle? How cool does it look? Does it look neat? Does it look avant-garde? How do they make you desire that beer that's in there? Do you want hops? Do you want less hops? Do you want flavor? Do you want a Kolsch? Do you want a seasonal beer? Do you want a limited run? Do you want, this is their flagship, the one they're best known for? How to get yourself on tap in a restaurant or bar is a major victory for these brewers. That's something we'll go into as well. But here's where I wanted to start things. The world of brewing is fascinating to me, and I didn't know a lot of this. Again, that's kind of been the theme as I've done my research for each one of these shows. So in the U.S. right now, there are about 8,300 U.S. breweries, okay? That's as of the end of 2019, start of 2020. Around 7,900 to 8,000, numbers approximate, are microbreweries of some kind. We'll go into that definition here in a second. That number has changed since 2006 when there were only 1,700 breweries in the United States. 8,300 now, 1,700 in 2006. You look at a graph, and it's basically like a rocket ship. It's like SpaceX going up, 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 up. The number has jumped 4-5-fold in really the last 10, 15 years. Amazing to me, right? I didn't consider that. I knew the market was flooding. I just didn't realize how much. Some incredible numbers in there. But let's back up. There's some definitions and a few things that, again, I didn't know before I started to do this. So the Brewers Association, which sounds very, very fancy, not to be confused with the Milwaukee Brewers and what they do, but this is a Brewers Association. That was a terrible Milwaukee Brewers joke, by the way. I apologize for making it. Point is, the Brewery Association basically has definitions for how much you produce, and that influences what you're actually called as a brewery, right? So microbreweries, annual production of less than 15,000 U.S. beer barrels, which roughly turns into about 460,000 gallons of beer. So they do beer barrels kind of the way that OPEC does barrels of oil, right? Slightly less in terms of volume. Brewpubs, which sell 25% or more of their beer on site, meaning they've got some beers, they got some distribution, but a quarter of their sales have to be at the spot where the beer is made. Regional craft breweries, this is kind of the big up here, which make 15,000, between 15,000 and 6 million U.S. beer barrels, a huge one. So think of something that you've seen before if you're in the eastern part of the United States. Yingling, one of the oldest breweries, if not the oldest brewer in North America, I think it was founded in 1829, was reclassified now as a regional craft brewery. It's big, but it's still thought of as a craft brewery, according to this designation. So then the final designation is contract breweries, which hire other breweries to make their beer. So that's one that we won't really go into much here at all. So the macro breweries are simply just called breweries. That's Budweiser, that's Coors, that's Miller, that's all the big boys that you know and are certainly used to in society. But some interesting data there. So now you go back into the numbers and some of the volume of beer and the way that it's kind of changed. The marketplace, again, is so flooded. In 2006, I mentioned there are around 1,700 breweries in the United States. That number, again, has grown to 8,300, all the way up to about 8,500 at some point estimated by the end of this year. Now, granted, with pandemic stuff, may not be the case, but that was the trend. So where does that leave us? Well, here come the big important numbers. Money, right? Just 13.6% of the market share went to craft breweries. Just 13.6% in the U.S., and this is as of 2019. Imports got 19%. What do you think the rest was? 67% for domestic. And then there's a bunch of little micro things in there. But basically, craft breweries, microbreweries, tap rooms, brew pubs, all the rest are fighting for just over 10% of the market share. 13.6% of the market share. $29.3 billion done last year by these individual breweries, right? These smaller scale breweries. Think about how competitive that space is. You're not going to knock down too much more from the domestic beers, from the big boys, right? From Budweiser. You can only take a small little chunk out, maybe locally at this grocery store or that one, but it's never going to slow down that giant machine. You're fighting inch by inch to climb up that market share. So you're basically, I don't want to say scraps from the table, but you're trying to find space where you push down that big display of the big boys, right? And that's kind of why something I sort of discovered in doing this, a lot of these craft breweries, a lot of these micro beers are sort of in this together. And there's a feeling of camaraderie among them where anytime, you know, one of them gets a small victory, gets themselves into a restaurant, get themselves on tap at a bar, it feels like kind of they all won. They want people to change away from what they're used to. The brands that you've seen before, the imports, you know what they look like. You know what the domestics look like. They want you to consider a craft beer. A consideration for a craft beer means, in effect, they've won. Total of 26 billion barrels of craft beer in 2019. This is the number that jumped out at me. The production of beer by these microbrews, 26 billion barrels in 2019. That's up from just 7 billion in 2005. In 14 years, you basically quadrupled the amount of production of these microbrews, but still only for 13.6% of the market share, and that's as high as it has ever been. But interesting stuff, fascinating, things I didn't know. Can't wait to have my guests come on. Ben Evans will join me here in a moment. Have plenty to ask him about and some of the hidden challenges, his background as a chemist, a neuroscientist. He knew so much, and he decided, screw it, I'm making beer. His story is great. Listen to him next. Really excited about my guest this week on You Seem Interesting. He is Chief Executive Brewlord, the Overlord of Brewing at Hellbender Brewery. He's the founder, CEO, and lead brewer of that wonderful beer purveyor. Mr. Ben Evans joins me. Ben, thanks for the time this afternoon, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Danny.
It is a pleasure, dude. It's really cool. I want to go into how you got where you are. It's a cool story. I want to get into what you guys do. But just kind of in general, tell folks about Hellbender. When'd you start? What makes that beer or that brewery special?
Yeah, we're about 5.5 years old. I've been brewing, did my first homebrew batches when I was just about almost 20 years old with my dad. I was brewing when I was coming home from college with my dad and my brother. It was only a few times a year that I was doing it. So sort of started learning the process way, way back. My story from there kind of is the reason we are kind of unique, I guess. And that kind of continues through college. I continued to brew sort of on and off. And then really after college, I got really into it. I was a neuroscience major in college. I was also a Division I wrestler in college. The summer between college and grad school, which I also went to grad school for neuroscience, I was sort of really bored. I moved in with my parents that summer and was looking for something to do. I started bartending at a bar that had a lot of craft beer, but really I joined a rugby team, and it turned out one of the guys on my team was the head brewer at Iron Hill Brewing Company, and started teaching me how to brew and taking me over there. And I spent a lot of that summer kind of learning the ropes from him. Yeah, kind of just really got that feel initially for the brewing on a bigger system. Yeah, I just thought it was a lot of fun, really fascinating, a lot of hard work too. So I guess throughout grad school, I kept going down there whenever I could get a chance and brew with them. And I continued to do research in neuroscience, started seeing all of the doctoral candidates and stuff, basically all the postdocs mm-hmm. that I knew and thought were brilliant people struggling to find jobs and find placements after all this massive amount of education. Started thinking maybe it's just as risky to open up a business. I started writing a business plan, started kind of putting things together a little bit, and took me a better part of 4 years of work to kind of get to the point where we opened our doors.
No, it is amazing. It's the natural extension, right, between neuroscience and beer. I mean, tried and true road. And I think so many of us can relate to that, where what you thought you were going to do, what you started out to do, is not where you ended up, but you wouldn't have ended up there if you didn't start out on that certain path that you took. So I think that's really relatable. I think what people, Ben, what they think of when it's like, oh, I work at a brewery, I'm the lead brewer. I think everyone thinks of like Beer Fest, where you guys are just the Wolfhausens, yeah. You know, just knocking back beers and everything is just so much fun. It's a great big party. But while it's not a conventional thing where you're in a cubicle every day just pushing TPS reports across your desk, you got to have adult parts of that thing, right? Where you got to be a business person. You have to look out, and there's branding and all sorts of other things that go into it. So just to that end, what don't people know about the beer industry that really is sort of along those lines?
Yeah, I mean, so I'll be canning all day tomorrow, but for instance, today was a light day. I was prepping two brand new beers, getting them cold crashed and starting to carbonate them. I'm carbonating a new beer to can out tomorrow along with our it's basically two of our flagships. I had a steam boiler part basically to our hot liquor tank go down yesterday, ordered an overnight part. I'm going to replace that tomorrow afternoon after I'm done with canning. I'd have that thing overnighted so that our entire hot water source doesn't drain out every night. Mm. There was a valve that failed. So I'm currently carbonating a beer right this minute. I need to put in another can order. I was just doing inventory taking assessments of, you know, how much inventory we have for all of our 12-ounce cans that we're going to be using for the next couple weeks, and realize I'm a little lower than I thought and have to put another order in. You know, getting that together. Looks like businesses might start opening up because of this pandemic pretty soon, and we're going to probably stay shut down for a little while and keep doing our to-go service. So I'm trying to get a social media announcement together for that. And yeah, I've got a bunch of other phone calls to make, but it's sort of, yeah, we're...
It's a party.
Yeah. It's a lot of, you make a lot of lists, basically, and you go through your day and check stuff off, do your best to stay on top of the massive amount of stuff that's happening all the time. So it's, fun times, but I can't say I don't love it. Guys on tours that say, oh man, you must like drink all the time, or do you drink while you work? And I was like, no, well... when I'm back here brewing, we're essentially working with hazardous chemicals, high temperatures, high pressures, dangerous machinery. Basically, I love my beer, and I will absolutely drink some beers when I'm done for the day, whenever that happens to be. But on a daily basis, you know, there's a lot of work from early morning until usually pretty late evening. So.
And it's a wide variety too, which I think a lot of people don't necessarily appreciate, because it's your business as well as the product, kind of your baby that you're talking about. Yeah. So one of the things I wanted to get into with you, Ben, was that craft beer, it's such a crowded marketplace. It's now, I think, what, close to 10,000 individual small breweries in the U.S. I don't know if that's a totally up-to-date number, but it's an explosion from what it used to be. But do you guys consider other craft breweries competitors or no?
I do. I guess I don't think about it that much on a daily basis. I think there's, in a lot of ways, we're still trying to educate the public, at least hopefully most of us are, that about craft beer. We still have a lot of people that come in that don't really know what either we're all about or what the styles that we're making are all about, and have a lot of questions. So I'm hoping not only are the brewers, for instance, making just a good Kolsch, which is a light ale that's very lager-like. I don't want somebody to taste a Kolsch at another brewery and say, oh, Kolsch is nasty, I don't ever want to try this style again, because we make a Kolsch that we work very hard to make that taste very good. And that's sort of a small example, but I don't bother thinking so much about the competition as just trying to make our brand awareness out there. You know, we're staying relevant and staying consistent with our flagships, and, you know, getting really creative and out there and interesting with our new styles of beer, one-offs, and the labels that go along with that. And just kind of trying to do fun events and things like that to just kind of keep people interested in us and keep people coming in here and trying our beer. And as long as we're working as hard as we can to stay interesting and relevant, I don't really think that much about, I guess, the competition side of it. It's sort of, an internal driver more than anything for us.
What's the premium thing? Is it being at bars, being on tap at bars? Is it shelf space at you know, grocery stores, liquor stores, et cetera? What are kind of the challenges that you guys have in getting yourself in front of people so that, you know, folks that may not be privy to whatever social media discover Hellbender?
It's tough. Our biggest source of revenue is absolutely draft at bars and restaurants. So, you know, it's really a lot easier and less labor intensive and less packaging sort of the costs for us to put stuff into kegs and send it out to our distributor, and then who then gets it out to bars and restaurants. So that's really our primary. I think second most after that would be our tap room, which, you know, right now is a little different with the pandemic. We actually are selling a ton of stuff out the front of the door to go. After that, then, would be currently our canning outside can sales at grocery stores and liquor stores, but we're slowly growing that right now. Again, I wouldn't say right now because of the pandemic, but we were getting ready to get into some more liquor store, grocery store chains before this all hit, as well as a big part of Maryland. So, yeah, those are the three big ones, though. It's draft number one, and then tap room and cans.
So you mentioned a distributor, Ben. Go into that relationship. Is that hard to pick the right one? Do they recruit you? You recruit them? How do you find the distributor that's best suited for you? And kind of, you know, what's the Goldilocks there to get the thing that's just right so that they get you in front of the right people? How do you pick a distributor?
We have a great relationship with our distributor right now. We've had two pretty terrible distributor relationships. Definitely a question I could really get into. Long story short was, you know, you need a distributor that's going to work with you. And really it's somebody that's going to, whether it's one person or multiple people that are working with you, somebody that's going to communicate, and somebody you can bounce ideas or talk off of and talk to and sort of get a game plan together. You know, it's not their job necessarily to sell all of your product. You need a salesperson within your own brewery that's going to go out and kind of pound the pavement every day and sell your beer. And we have a person that does that. That's their sole job, is to go out, sample beers to bars and restaurants and liquor stores and places and try to get us on tap or in six packs on the shelves. But yeah, a good distributor, it's really about communication, and you need to know how big you can be as well and whether they can accommodate that. I think we started out with a medium-sized distributor, but there was a complete lack of communication where, yeah, things got, it ended up, our first distributor really felt like we were dealing more with the mafia than with a company that was trying to help us out. And then our second distributor, we had a lot of problems. They were very small, had a lot of issues paying bills and things like that. That became a problem, but we've got a very large distributor now. We have a person that's assigned to us that will chat with us if we want to say we're working on getting into X grocery store or chain. We kind of figure out a game plan and talk with that person, and they'll put us in touch with the right people within the distributor to get us in front of the right person at that grocery store chain. And, you know, we kind of go from there and give them sales goals every year, and they'll do their best to hit them. And I really have no complaints right now. It's been really good. We've been with these guys for about close to 2 years now. So
good. That's nice to find that, right? Because if you do well, they do well, and then the whole nine yards. So looking at your beer selection, I always think this is fascinating because I take hours to name a fantasy football team, and I'll change it like 50 times and have trouble. This is a product that's going on shelves in front of thousands of people, or, you know, on tap or whatever, as opposed to, you know, the 11 other people in my fantasy league, right? How do you pick names? How involved is that? I mean, like, there's references that I get, for example, your Pomeranian bowling league, clearly a Lebowski reference. Marty, Cynthia and Marty Ackerman's Pomeranian, you brought it bowling, the whole nine yards. How do you decide on that stuff? And is it sometimes easy? Is it complicated? Go through that.
It's tough. My other brewer and myself have a shared Google Drive with like hundreds of names we have come up with while drinking or while totally sober or a million other ways. I've just sometimes woken up and written a few names down on that list and sort of, they're not so much concrete names as a lot of them are like jumping off points, like Big Lebowski references and things like that. If I'm watching a movie, sometimes I'll hear something and I'm like, oh my God, that's an awesome beer name. And sometimes names will inspire a beer and sometimes the beer will inspire a name. And the new challenge now is we're doing a lot more can one-offs in six packs and four packs. That's been the real challenge, is every 6 or 8 weeks now I'll sit down. We've got a guy that's awesome that does graphic design. I'll chat with him about a can design, some vague idea, and he'll come up with something that looks amazing. At least I think so. And yeah, we've gotten a lot of compliments lately on a lot of his new designs and stuff too. But about every 8 weeks, I'll try to plan out for the next 8 weeks of can releases. And that's like roughly about a can release every week that we're going to be doing from here on out. And that gets challenging because then I have to talk with him, get a label conceptualized and kind of figured out, and then get the name wrapped in there too. And I'll have to then get the proofs from him, tell him whether I like him or not, or he has to change some little thing. I have to take that over to our printer guys. So luckily the guys that do our labels, or at least the sales guy in this area for that label company, is good friends with our graphic design guys. So they can go back and forth a little bit without me having to do literally everything, which is, a massive load off of my back, which is amazing. you know, also with labels, I try to do them in bulk and guesstimate what my yields of beer are going to be, so I don't have extras laying around if I'm never going to brew that beer again. So it's sort of, yeah, I've got a little Excel file that I've made with my expected beer yields and barrels, and then how many labels that's going to translate to, and I'll just kind of round them up or down. Yeah, it's a whole process. We just released the first of our new cycle of labels last week with a beer called Fringe Class, which is an Always Sunny reference, and it's a sort of a rough drawing of Danny DeVito with like drool or like beer foam coming out of
awesome.
His mouth.
Awesome.
So a lot of people think it's like an old man drooling that don't know It's Always Sunny, and I'm like, yeah, that's true.
Both can be true.
Yeah, it's fine. The latest label is so cool because it's like shiny golden. It just looks so gaudy and classless, but like it just looks really cool and eye-catching at the same time. I'm like, that's perfect for Fringe Class. I'm like, it's so great. Yeah, sometimes things just really work out too. But we've got a whole stack of new labels. I'm releasing a new double IPA and a session IPA both next week. Those are the beers I was kind of getting finished up today.
What's your favorite kind of beer to make, and what's your least favorite style of beer to make?
Oh man, my favorite styles of beer to make are usually my least favorite to drink, I would say. And not that I don't enjoy everything we make. I think at heart, I'm just a hop head. I really like the super aromatic hoppy beers, and I like a lot of Belgian style beers too. But I think my go-to, some sort of insanely aromatic, you know, whether it's a pale ale, a double IPA, a triple IPA, or just a regular IPA, something that's not too bitter, but just really aromatic. And that involves dry hopping. Those suck. The dry hopping is a pain. You lose a lot of beer because hops kind of act like a sponge and just sort of absorb beer and then drop to the bottom of your tank, and you lose all that beer that's stuck in the hops. They're very expensive to make. Hops are extremely expensive. You lose a lot of beer that way. But you have to dry hop for, you know, you're adding like a week to the process with dry hopping versus just an un-dry hop beer like Kolsch or our Red Line is not dry hopped, or most Belgian beers that we're making, Saisons or Belgian Blondes and stuff like that. So conversely, yeah, the Saisons or Kolsch or Red Line Ale, yeah, any of the non-dry hop beers are generally pretty quick fermentations. All you have to do is then press a button to cool the tank down. Once it's crashed down close to freezing for a few days, you can transfer over to a bright tank, which is where it lagers or stays cold, carbonate the beer, and then just let it lager a little longer and can or keg it out versus all the extra steps for dry hopping. So
nice, dude. Yeah. I find that stuff so fascinating that you just sort of intuitively know it. And I'm going, you see, there's alcohol in there. Like, I just don't know anything, and I enjoy drinking them when they're done. That is really neat. Last one for you, man, before I let you jump. Give me kind of a touchdown dance moment. Give me like like you just scored the winner, spike in your face, great type moment. And give me your lowest moment, maybe, as where you go, oh my God, this kind of blew up in our face. Give me a highlight and give me a low light.
Okay. Low light. We've only ever dumped one batch on the large scale since we opened 5.5 years ago, and thankfully it was an equipment malfunction. It wasn't us that screwed it up, but we had a batch of our American Red Ale that went into fermentation, but then a solenoid valve that controls glycol, which chills the tank, popped open and didn't close during fermentation right at the beginning. Like, it barely had even started fermenting, like, so that means when the yeast starts eating the sugar and making alcohol, you know, the day you brew it. So the thing chilled down below the temperature that the yeast liked, and we didn't catch it for about 24 hours because it was just a really crazy busy day that next day. And I came over and saw like condensation on the door of the fermenter. This is like a 50 keg batch of beer, so not small. Basically, I tried to let it warm back up and tried a few different other tricks to get it to re-ferment, but it had kind of killed the yeast or made it dormant. It started developing a funky, weird kind of wild yeast flavor kind of thing. And again, this happened maybe about 3 months into our opening of the brewery. I just did not like the flavor. I didn't like what was going on. So I put a hose at the bottom of the fermenter and opened up and let it go down the drain. So that sucked. That was, yeah, watching essentially 50 kegs worth of beer rush down the drain, was a real, real crap moment. So that's, yeah, it's tough. Yeah, also the worst moments are usually kind of seared into your brain a little bit more than the good ones.
100%.
Yeah. The you don't want to think about them, but you revisit them.
Totally.
There are a lot of small moments I can think of too, where, you know, over the years we've learned little tricks and techniques where we have been able to get more flavor and aroma out of dry hopping, which is something we do a lot of without adding any extra hops, basically improving our techniques. So anytime we're able to do that, whether it be higher temperatures of dry hopping or letting the hops warm up properly and all this other stuff, yeah, just little things where we're like, oh my God, this is the same recipe with all the same weights going into it and everything else, but it smells and tastes like way better all of a sudden, just because of some stupid little trick we did. And we're like, you know, that's always very exciting. I'm trying to think of something that's like really substantial and not just like, oh yeah, we dry hopped a little bit better.
No, that's a good answer too, though. It's like a little tip and trick to make it easier for you. I mean, it could be something like you know, you went to a bar and you saw your beer in the bar for the first time, or, you know, whatever, anything like that.
Yeah. I mean, that one's definitely, that novelty never really wears off. I'm always like, oh shit, I made that. That's so cool. A very, very cool feeling. And, you know, even more so if, you know, I can see people are enjoying it or ordering it. I've had some friends that are bar owners or bar managers text me before that at some pretty large bars with a lot of different craft beers and macro beers and stuff that have texted me that, you know, I had one really good friend that owns a beer garden text me, and this is still ongoing, that our beer is has been their number one seller for like a year there out of like 20 something taps. And I'm like, that felt pretty good. I was like, that's freaking awesome. That's like, yeah, just kind of, yeah, one of those moments like, yeah, I know that beer is already selling really well. Our Ignite is probably, you know, definitely our biggest seller, our Ignite American IPA, but seeing it sort of go toe-to-toe with beers from all over the country and actually outsell them in a market that's, you know, so I would say DC is very transient in a lot of ways. You know, the brand loyalty is sort of all over the place. And yeah, seeing a beer like that just in a crowded IPA market do that, that's always pretty awesome. So
no, that's very cool, man. Well, congrats on all your success. Thanks for hanging out with me today. I know you are super, super busy, but really appreciate the time, man. You're interesting as hell, dude. Thank you so much.
Thanks, man. Yeah, if you guys ever want to, if anybody listening ever wants to sign up for open mic, we're doing it online for the moment, but yeah, I'll be playing at 6:15 tonight, my set, something we do every single Wednesday. I hope that sometime it'll be in the fairly near future, it'll be back in the bar again, because that's where it's really fun. But looking forward to that. That's my stress relief. So,
dude, thank you so much, man. Really appreciate the time, bud.
All right. Cheers. Have a great night.
You too, pal. See ya.
Bye.
Thanks again to Ben Evans, lead brewer at Hellbender Brewing in Washington, D.C. That was really cool. I like this show. I like doing this show a lot, and I'm tooting my own horn here, because I get to talk to a vastly different person each and every week and find out more about what they do and some of the challenges and some of the industries and the marketplaces and things that I would never have thought of. And I think part of this journey that we're all kind of going on and I'm doing here is I get to find out about cool stuff that I wouldn't normally have done the research on. So it's interesting. I had that same image. And when Ben mentioned, when he referenced in the interview, everybody just thinks we sit around and drink all the time. I fully admit that I thought that. I work at a brewery. Well, that guy's routine includes tasting every beer that they offer and then, you know, settling on one winner for the night and drinking 11 of them. It just seemed to be to go with the lifestyle, right? Of course that was part of it. Of course that's not the case. Of course he's dealing with boiling water and yeast and fermentation and chemistry on a level that I could never comprehend. You could give me 100 years to try to figure out what he does. Even if I just watched him without specific instruction, I'd have no idea. Of course it's complicated. If you've done a brewery tour, you've seen it, right? You've seen, you know, this part where they're heating up the mash, or this other part where they're fermenting this. You just go, oh yeah, fermenting. What's fermenting? Top of your head right now. Do you know? I had to look it up. I'll tell you that right now. So the point is, it is a more complicated and involved process. And then he talked about one of the kind of failure moments, just components and elements of the process that I never would have heard of, you never would have thought of. You always have these things, right? It's like home ownership. You buy the house, it passed inspection, everything looks great, and you know, you're in there for 27 days and your hot water heater, a small little gasket explodes and it's going to cost you thousands. Well, that wasn't in the budget. We didn't anticipate that. But when you're running a business, it's like that. Your house, except it's infinitely more, right? It's what you got coming in and what you're producing. And if that's hampered in any way, that is a major, major setback. I also loved a story there at the end about kind of the win and right what's and what works. Just these little tiny moments where you're just out and about, or a buddy in that case texted him at a beer garden. It's like, dude, your beer's right here, right? You made it. It's not a, I mean, I'm sure it was a huge deal when, you know, Budweiser got started, or when one of the big boys did, or an import that, you know, made its way over to the U.S. and, you know, finally had its market share. And it was, oh my gosh, we've arrived. It's such a cool thing. But think about it, just for the, it's like, you know, seeing your name in lights for the first time, or having that just be part of the selection, whether or not someone was ordering the thing or not. It's just, it's really, really cool to have those little tiny victories. I also was interested to hear his take on the distributors stuff. Now, I didn't want to like press and, you know, turn it into, you know, a negative and have him bash that one distributor that he was kind of referencing early on, but it's another hidden part about this industry, right? It's basically like, again, I always reference a sports background. I host a sports radio show in Washington, D.C., the Grant and Danny Show, and there are agents for players. Now, if you're a professional athlete, every team knows who you are. Every team is very aware of what you do. Every team has, you know, game tape and access to film, and you know, they got your former teammates, they got people they can talk to. There are plenty of resources, and still players hire agents for a very specific reason. It's that negotiation part. It's to increase the demand. It's to get a feverish marketplace to maximize the value. Well, imagine you've got an agent, but for a player that nobody's ever heard of. That's how I think of the distributor, basically, for a brewery. I know it's more complicated than that, but that's my view of it, right? It's somebody that's going out and selling and saying, this is why you need to be in business with these guys. Everybody's going to come in saying the same thing. Well, we're sustainable. We're environmentally this, we're that. This beer tastes great. This beer's got the most hops of any beer in the history of the world. And it's an IPA hop off. I mean, that's kind of how the development has gone, right? Getting the right distributor, finding that sweet spot, somebody that's going to give you the right amount of attention, but also stand by you and promote your beer, is such a huge thing. And it sounds like Hellbender and Ben are now really, really happy, you know, with who they have. And I think that's really, really cool. That was neat to hear as well. I just enjoyed that, man. I thought that was really fun. Again, it's different, and it's part of why I think doing the show was so much fun, just getting to know somebody that I wouldn't have otherwise come across. So I appreciate everybody that set that up. So that's going to do it for us. Thank you again to my guest, Ben Evans of Hellbender Brewery. Thank you to my producer, Andrew Russell of Kiwanda Sound. Go to kiwandasound.com for all your sound editing needs. Those guys are outstanding. And that's going to do it for us this week on You Seem Interesting. Thank you again for checking out the show. We are now widely available wherever you find your podcasts: iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn. Wherever you find them, you can find us. And of course, we're always at patreon.com/funnydanny if you want to support the show. Keep spreading the word. You can tweet us at @interest_pod. So until next week, thanks again. And you, yes, you seem interesting.